I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 26th of August. This hour, as students go back to school all over the state or about to do so, we're going to talk about really interesting idea. It may be controversial and it may not be the perfect way to get students to become totally engaged in learning, but it might be a step on the right path. It's called the flipped classroom. And what would customarily be defined as homework, problem sets, essay writing, is done by students during class hours when the teacher is there to supervise and to chat. And what was once the core of the classroom experience, teacher lectures, delineated lesson plans, are now absorbed at home via video tutorials. That's not all it is, and there's more to getting students enthused about learning, but we're going to be talking about this hour of our program with Aaron Sams. Aaron is president and CEO of Same Learning Designs. He taught chemistry and AP chemistry at Woodland Park High School in Colorado and also Los Altos High School in Hacienda Heights, California. He was awarded the 2009 Presidential Award for Excellence in Math and Science Teaching, served as co-chair of the Colorado State Science Standards Revision Committee, and he conducts workshops on educational screencasts and the flipped classroom concept. He believes in inquiry, student-centered learning environments, and that's all that we're going to be talking about, which is a lot this hour of the show. We would love to hear your thoughts about this flipped classroom. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Aaron, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Aaron. I think it's going to be a really interesting conversation. I just briefly described what the flipped classroom is. Please tell me in more detail.
Well, I really appreciated the way you described it in the idea of, students doing what was traditionally done in homework in class and what was traditionally done is direct instruction and lectures at home. But then you said that it doesn't stop there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what I typically call a flipped classroom 101. It's kind of the entry point that a lot of teachers have taken trying to get away from teacher-centered classrooms where they're doing a lot of direct instruction, a lot of telling and retelling and students just regurgitating information. And we've known for years that that's not the best way to teach. That's not the best way for students to learn. And yet a lot of us still keep doing that. I did that for the first, probably half of my career as a high school teacher. And a lot of us, we know we want to get away from that, but we're not sure exactly how. And I think this idea of leveraging the power of video as a really effective medium to deliver quick, low-level instructional content, we can shift that out of this group learning space and try to recuperate that time and make better use of it when you're face-to-face with your students, that's really kind of at the heart of the flipped classroom. And then that really gets you it forces teachers to ask the question, well, now what do I do in my class? What should I do? What's the best use of this time I have with my students?
So why isn't the lecture the best way to teach?
Well, just directed instruction. Well, we think it's efficient, I think, I deceived myself into thinking if I talk at 45 students or however many I have in my classroom that I have reached all 45 students, that's an efficient way to deliver content. But, after you've done that for a few years, you realize you're kind of shooting for the middle and hoping you get most, but there's always the outliers, the kids on the high end, the kids on the low end, the kids that are just bored or disinterested or distracted that are not engaged. And, we know from experience, we know from research sitting and hearing information is really not the best way to learn, but in actively engaging with something and then ultimately doing something with what you've learned and even teaching it to someone else is probably one of the best ways to learn. So this is just a way to step away from the kind of controlling everything that's going on at the same time in the classroom and delivering content strategically to individual students. So shifting the directed instruction out of the group learning space into the individual learning space.
So how do you keep them actively engaged if you're doing this electronically, essentially? If you're doing the lecture or the teacher imparting wisdom, how do you do that?
Yeah, so if you're using video as a teaching tool outside of this of the group class time, As a practitioner, what I did is I trained my students, here's an effective way to actually engage with video. Sometimes if I'm in my own house, I've got my computer open, I've got the television on, I'm texting my wife, I'm, you know, whatever. I've got 8 million devices out, and I'm doing 8 million things. I'm kind of multitasking, and I'm not doing any of them very well.
Right.
But when I sit down and I actually focus on one task, I can really engage, pour my energies into that one thing. So I teach my students, how to effectively watch a video. You have control of the pause button. You have control of the rewind button. You know, here are some fill-in-the-blank notes or some follow-along guides to help you through that. So it's not just a cold view. You know, as teachers, we don't give our kids cold reads. We don't say, here's a book, go. You know, we set the students up. We give them some context for which they'll be learning in. We give them some tools that they can use to be effective readers. We can give them tools to be effective viewers of content as well.
Mm-hmm. And the content you do is not just a dry lecture, is it? You're using some other tools of technology to impart the knowledge.
Right. Yeah. So. My videos that I created for my students were not just, you know, a video camera on me in front of a whiteboard or anything like that. I made this with my colleague, John, and we tried to make them as engaging as we could, so we threw a little humor in there. Sometimes we probably went over the top and wasted a little bit of their time, probably something I wouldn't do in another revision of these.
But, humor never wastes anybody's time. We know
well,
that,
it does
right?
if you go on for too long with it. But so that's one way. We travel a lot, and so we take our cameras with us, and if we see something that might be of interest to our students that would apply to our classroom, we'd throw a little 30-second video clip of us, you know, wherever we happen to be. There's one of John. He's in Peru, and he just filmed a little clip about the geology of the Andes Mountains and brought it back to his students. We're using some multimedia tools that you can find in video editing software and screencasting software to just try to bring it to life a little bit instead of just kind of stand and telling of information.
You obviously have to make sure that all of the students in your class have the appropriate technology at home, right?
Yes, absolutely. And that's a question that we asked ourselves before we really embarked down this road. We spoke to our principal, and he said, based on a self-reporting survey, that 25% of our community did not have access to the Internet at home. We were teaching up in the mountains of Colorado at the time. I did not have access to the Internet at home other than dial-up.
Mm.
So we had to make sure that our students did have access. And so the way we solved that problem is, we provided videos onto a flash drive or a DVD for our students. So flash drive for students who had a computer at home, DVDs for those who didn't but had a television and a DVD player. We were ready to pony up for some, for a DVD player for a student if they needed it, or a portable DVD player or some sort of device if a student did not have access at those means. We didn't need to do that, but I do know of other schools who have been willing to provide that form of access as well. And that was in 2007. You know, things have come a long ways in 6 years in terms of mobile devices, access to the Internet. You can, you know, if you have a mobile device, even if you don't have a data plan, you can go to your local coffee shop and get on their Wi-Fi and do things there. So these are becoming less of an issue, but it's certainly a question you must address prior to, requiring your students to do anything like this outside of class. So it's a solvable problem, one that needs to be addressed, but certainly not a deal breaker.
When I was reading with somebody who was a strong proponent, reading what he had to say about this, this statement came up, and I want you to comment on it. We need to create kids who are adaptable and who, when faced with a new problem, can solve it with whatever resources they have. And part of that means their technological resources, because students today are living in a very, very different world than when I went to school. And the technological resources are vast, and I assume it makes them more adaptable.
I would agree with that they are more adaptable, especially when they have to figure out what the best way for them to access a particular learning object is. So now I probably wouldn't turn my complete control over to my students, because I want to ensure they have access, but I did, you know, within the first week of class, ask my students to identify their means by which they are going to access the content. You know, tell me what that is, and if they haven't identified a way yet, I'm going to sit down and help them figure out what that means is going to be. So some of my students really like to do these at a computer. Other of my students, they would download these onto, you know, like an iPod or something. Others like to watch them on their phone, and others, you know, would bring in their own computer to my class and put them on there. Others would watch them on a tablet device or whatever. I really encourage them to find what's going to be best for them and to use that and to use it well. But then I would certainly help those who were having trouble determining what their best method was going to be. I did have students also who had the internet at home, who had a computer at home, but preferred to have these on a DVD that they could just watch on the television. Hmm. And I would provide that for them. So yeah, it's definitely figuring out. I want kids to know where to go for information, mm-hmm. Not necessarily, you know, all the information is here, you must go here for it, but figuring out how to find resources for problems that they face.
Because the resources, because of the internet, are there, aren't they?
They're everywhere.
They're there.
We certainly are not lacking for information, but knowing how to filter what we do find and
right.
finding reliable sources for that information is a very important skill we need to be teaching our students.
So how do you know that whatever means they're using, all of these students are watching that instead of doing video games?
I don't, to be honest. But So I took a pretty low-tech approach to finding out who had viewed the content and who didn't. Frankly, I just checked their notes. I said, show me something that shows me that you engaged with this particular video or whatever I had them viewing that night. And typically, you could tell the ones that did and the ones that didn't. Sometimes, obviously, some kids could copy their friends' notes, but, you know, the kids can copy their friends' homework as well. But actually, I think one of the best ways to find out if they engaged with it is just to ask them a question or to have them ask you a question of what they still don't understand. And so by building in those safeguards, I was able to quickly ascertain who had actually watched something and gotten something out of it and who had, you know, just copied their friend's notes. I do know other teachers who embed their videos on web pages and, you know, they'll embed a Google form underneath it and they'll take in information from the students that way so they know who viewed what when and where and how they were able to interact with it by, you know, having them answer a few questions, and then they'll know how to frame the conversation for class the next day.
And what happens in the class the next day?
You know, in my classroom, it was very much, let's put it this way. I was able to double the number of labs my students did the very first time.
Oh, my goodness, really?
So it's something, I mean, as a science teacher, I always wanted to do more, but I was kind of content stuck, I guess you could say. I was clinging to content, really worried about getting that out, and I didn't have a whole lot of time. So I was able to do that, but a lot of other teachers that I know, they're finally doing a lot of the things they've always wanted to do, but haven't really had the time because, like I said, they're clinging to content. So a lot of teachers are using this as an entry point to get into project-based learning, using this as an entry point to open up the idea of having kids engaged in inquiry-based learning experiences. So, you know, they're going to investigate something before they even approach them with direct instruction or content. But a lot of teachers, they just haven't had the opportunity to take those plunges because they've been so strapped for time and so wrapped up with content. This really, once you have an archive of content, it allows you to explore things that you wouldn't necessarily do otherwise because you have the opportunity to do so.
And are you convinced, Aaron, that inquiry-based is the best way to learn?
I think it's certainly a very valuable way to learn. I don't know if it's probably the exclusively best way. There's a lot of research that shows that when students, go through this process of investigation and the idea of concept construction, that cognitively it's a very, very valuable way to learn. It's an extremely rich learning experience, but it's not very efficient. I don't know. I mean, it takes a long time to go through this inquiry process. And those of us who have, you know, lots of state standards and lots of required content to teach, I don't necessarily have the time and resources to be able to go through an entire inquiry cycle with every topic
right.
I need to teach. So there's great value in it, but I'm not sure it's practical for everything.
And the flipped classroom works best for a certain kind of subject like science and math, or it works for all subjects equally well?
I would say it looks different in different subject areas. I've found that it's extremely effective in topics that are very sequential and build upon themselves and have kind of a concrete subject area. So science, mathematically based science classes, chemistry and physics, I think math works really well. Grammar, it's very good at it as well. More of the, I guess, more nebulous and humanities-oriented things, probably not so much. My wife was a seventh-grade English teacher. She's probably my biggest critic. She says, I would never use this in my classroom. My class was all reading and discussion. I said, then it's great. Your kids read the book at home, and they come to class and they discuss it. I'm doing mm-hmm. the same thing in my chemistry class. I'm just leveraging a different medium for content delivery. So, I mean, pedagogically, this is really nothing new. Literature teachers have been doing this for hundreds of years, but so it looks different. So I know literature teachers who do use this idea of video for content delivery as kind of a unit overview, or history teachers who will, very brief, content area things where, historical factoids, things like that. And then when they get to class, they really dive deeper, get into some more primary documents, things like that.
Yeah. So what about, I compare this in a way to a talk show, because we're doing somewhat educational every hour usually. Sometimes it's just fun and entertaining, but you come away from the end of the week and you have learned so much. And part of what I love is when the audience calls and interacts with you and with each other. So you've got this great discussion going, and they may agree or they may disagree, but they're all bringing something to the table. How do you get those kinds of discussions going in this type of learning?
Yeah, those kind of things happen, I think, during some directed instruction in classrooms. But I know when I was a high school student, I loved trying to get my teacher off on a tangent where we wouldn't actually get to the content because we had them telling stories about something else.
Right.
And those are great. Those are fun little rabbit trails to chase, but a lot of times you can kind of get stuck, and you do get behind in your content, and you'll lose some of that. So those are still great little stories and great rabbit trails to chase during class. But if the content is already there and archived and accessible, and the students have already gotten, I guess, the stuff of learning, and then they come to class, you want them to have those conversations. You want to facilitate those conversations, but now you don't have to do that at the expense of getting to the content. You can I guess feel good and responsible as a teacher of chasing some of those down there. But that is one thing you do lose, though, with this particular style of learning, is the spontaneous, hey, wait a second, I have a question. Mm-hmm. Right in the middle. Now, I encourage my students to write those down, to bring them to class. We would start class every day with some of those question and answer periods. I would encourage students to even, I had a public Facebook page that my students use for a little while, or just, text me or email me with your question, and I'll, try to answer it right then and there. I'll say table that, and we'll talk about it in class, because I think it'll generate some good discussion in class.
And with the technology, you can do all of that, unless you have 50 kids asking you something. You can do all of that fairly rapidly, can't you? Because everything, when I look at young people, they're rapid fire all the time. The devices are fast, they're talking to a lot of people at one time, and then they've got a message thing going on, and then they're posting something themselves. There's so much information being exchanged all the time.
Oh yeah, definitely. And a lot of teachers, they're leveraging tools like Edmodo or other types of learning management systems where the kids are engaged in the same type of conversation, but they're just doing it, at home in a format that they're familiar and comfortable with. Edmodo is laid out very much like Facebook, and so the kids are very comfortable with that format. And so if they're viewing content or expected to have read something, and they're just quickly posting a comment about it right then and there, and they're commenting on each other's comments, and you've got a really rich learning community going on completely outside of the classroom, and then you can use that as a launching point for the in-class time when you're face-to-face with your kids.
Aaron Sams, our guest this hour, he taught chemistry and AP chemistry at Woodland Park High School in Colorado, won the 2009 Presidential Award for Excellence in Math and Science Teaching. He is one of the founding fathers of the flipped classroom concept, and we're talking about that this hour. Students are encouraged to learn and demonstrate their understanding in ways that are meaningful to them. And a lot of video is used here, but the whole idea of having your lecture in class and then you go home and do your homework is just flipped. What do you think? Maybe some of you are using this, or you love the idea and you want to know how, or you're troubled by some aspects of the idea. We'd love to hear from you, and here's how you call us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Aaron Sams, our guest now. We have a lot of phone calls coming in, so let's go to Peter in La Crosse first. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for taking this, and this show is fabulous.
Thanks.
Aaron, my students know you. They know Jonathan.
How do they know him?
They've spent a number of nights watching some of his videos. I've made some of my own, and they think mine are so lame. I find another number of other videos. There's no downside to this process. This is one of the most efficient ways of teaching I've found. I've been teaching chemistry since 1975 in one form or another. I teach chemistry and AP chemistry. This is efficient. It buys time, and the students love it. It works.
Okay, well,
Karen, thank you.
Wait, Peter, don't go away yet. Why does it work so well for you?
They are engaged to watch these things. They want to watch videos. They want to be, you have to train them. You have to show them what to do, how to listen, how to pay attention. And if you can create your own, you get your point across exactly how you want. And when they come into the classroom the next day, Aaron's correct. One or two questions, and you know if they've read the video, watched the videos or not. And all I have to do is put up an example and say, analyze, and the class begins discussing.
Hmm.
It is amazing. In all the years I've been teaching, this is one thing that works.
Aaron.
Yes.
Well, you must be happy to hear that call.
Well, it's very exciting to hear that. You know, he brings up a rather interesting question that I'm often asked is, do I need to make my own content or should I use some stuff that's already out there on the
mm-hmm.
internet? And I have kind of mixed feelings about that a little bit. I mean, you know, he's very kind in saying that his students liked my stuff. But to be honest, I prefer when I train teachers to do this is that they make their own content. He did mention that if you are making your own videos, you know exactly what you need to convey to your students. And kids everywhere are different. I mean, chemistry is chemistry. It doesn't really matter. But, you know, different textbooks use different types of vocabulary. Different teachers have different vocabulary. Different states have different state standards. So I definitely encourage teachers to consider creating their own content specifically for their students. Now, that doesn't mean that others can't benefit from others' content, but I really think it's best if a teacher makes their videos for their students. There's a relational aspect there as well. I mean, when a student hears their teacher's voice, sees their teacher's face, sees their teacher's handwriting on a video, the student knows that their teacher put some time and effort into that, and hopefully there's some sort of social contract that happens there that the students will then in turn put some time and effort into doing what the teacher would like mm-hmm. them to do in class as well.
Well, teachers can always learn from expert teachers, right? So you can help teach teachers how to put these together.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. We've got a whole community online of teachers who are using this concept and of sharing ideas, you know, in terms of content, sharing ideas in terms of content creation, sharing ideas of, you know, best practice in their subject-specific or grade-level-specific classroom, and I love the idea of sharing ideas and sharing content.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of teachers, you know, a good entry point is to start using other people's stuff, and then as you feel comfortable creating your own content or find that a particular piece is not meeting your needs, to replace it with something that you've made yourself.
Yes. Peter, thank you so much for your call. Jason in New Berlin, hi.
Hello, how are you?
All right, Jason, how are you?
Good. I just turned on the radio a little while ago and recognized a familiar voice and thought I would chime in. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, how you doing?
Very good. Aaron Sams wrote a great foreword to a book that was just published called Flipping 2.0.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of a how-to book on you know, what comes next and how to move toward flip learning. And it's written by 18 different teachers throughout the country and one from Canada talking about their experiences they all give great credit to Aaron Sams and John Bergman, sort of for their inspiration on getting them back into loving the teaching that they were doing.
Hmm. Aaron?
So Jason and many of those who contributed to that particular book are colleagues of mine who I've been working with for a number of years. Jason and some of those others, they were kind enough to come to our conference this year that we held in Stillwater, Minnesota, and help do some pre-conference training and give a lot of presentations. And we're just thankful that we've got a community of teachers who are out there that are sharing their experience, sharing their expertise, and getting their stories out there as well. You know, I've been telling my story for quite a few years, and I love that others are gaining a voice in that and able to share how this has really transformed their teaching practice and kind of what it's led them to and some of the great things that they can do in the classroom now that they have time to do so and are not, like I've said earlier, not just clinging to content and focus too much on content delivery.
How long have you been doing this? How long have the videos been around?
I started using video in my classroom in the 2006-2007 school year. Mm-hmm. At that point, I started recording my lessons live and making them available to students who were gone for whatever reason, you know, school activities or illnesses. And then I realized that this is a great tool for asynchronous learning, and so my colleague John and I, we committed to pre-recording all of our lessons in the 2007-2008 school year. So we created content for chemistry and AP chemistry that year. Generally speaking, we were about 3 days ahead of the of where our students were, so we were making a lot of content on the fly. And then after that, once we built up this library of content, we moved to what we call our flipped mastery model, where students are able to move through the content at a more flexible pace and work through the material. I don't want to say self-paced because we still taught September to May, but at a pace that was reasonable for them, and we're able to meet a lot of the individual learning needs a lot better that way with this asynchronous classroom.
Thanks, Jason, for your call. Matt in Minocqua. Hi, Matt.
Hello. In general, I'm in favor of a flipped classroom concept, but I recently had a college course where they relied on a lot of video content, and the lectures were really horrible. And my question is, how is a professor or teacher going to improve their content if they just rely on this archival footage that they've collected maybe a year or 2 years previously? Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a very good question. You definitely don't want to let it run too long. To be honest, my content is in desperate need of refreshing right now. Unfortunately, I'm out of the chemistry classroom and I'm not teaching anymore, so the chances of my content being refreshed anytime soon is pretty slim. But I do encourage teachers to go back and take a look at their material every couple of years. So as I mentioned, John and I made all of our content in 2007-2008. We refreshed all of the AP chemistry content in 2008-2009, and we refreshed all of the chemistry content the year after that. Definitely don't just kind of, you know, make it and check it off and consider it done. Those involved in online courses and blended learning courses, seems to be the refresh cycle is about, you know, every 3 years or so. And so that's a good, kind of a good, I think, time frame to keep continuing to refresh this this actual content. But, you know, tweak and modify as you go. But, you know, I guess if you've got a really boring lecturer, putting them on video is not going to make them any more exciting.
That's right.
Technology has this very unique ability to amplify, and it amplifies the good and it amplifies the bad. So this is not going to make a mediocre teacher better necessarily, but it can make a pretty good teacher. It can really enhance the good that they're already doing. So, I mean, quality is something you really need to be thinking of. And, you know, another way to look at this, and there's some schools that I've worked with that have done this, they have found kind of they play to the strengths of their teachers, I should say. So if they have a math department, let's say of six teachers, two of them are really good presenters of content, two of them might be really good at assessment, and two of them might be great at developing in-class activities. Well, let them play to those strengths. Have two of them create video content, have two of them work on assessment, have two of them work on things to be done in class, and then share all of the materials in six separate, you know, teachers' classrooms. I think it's a great approach to leveraging some of these powerful electronic tools.
Thanks, Matt, for the call. How long are these lectures or these videos?
Mine are too long, so I'll just start out by saying that. But our general rule of thumb is about 1 minute per grade level. So if you've got, you know, fifth graders, I wouldn't make them any longer than, you know, 5 or 7 minutes.
Oh, my goodness, they're short.
Yeah, I definitely think this should be short. You get a lot of bang for your buck with video content early on, but the longer it goes on, the more people try to trail off. I've seen graphs of YouTube traffic, and, you know, after the first 5 minutes, the viewership just almost completely disappears after anything longer than that. So we really encourage people to, you know, keep it brief, keep it short, develop the ideas in class, you know, one-on-one or in small groups with the students. But the nice thing is what used to take me 30 minutes to do in class now takes me 15 minutes to do on a video because I don't have a lot of interruptions. Now, some of those were good interruptions, students asking questions, students, you know, going down those rabbit trails that we talked about earlier. But some of those were not so good interruptions, you know, someone coming over the intercom asking for Johnny to go down to the office,
right.
You know, dealing with discipline issues or, you know, students interrupting or not paying attention and things like that, mm-hmm. that we teachers always deal with. So those things kind of disappear as well. So, but yeah, keep them short and then develop the concepts later.
Well, it made me wonder, as you were saying this, is this an indication that attention spans, perhaps because of all of this technology and flipping channels and going, having conversations one after another on your on your cell phone or your smartphone, that attention spans are much shorter now, and so you can't have longer lectures. And is that a good thing?
Attention spans are probably shorter. I know my attention span is certainly not as long as it used to be, just given the way I consume media. But I don't think that necessarily means you have to cut down on the amount of content that you're doing. So the first year that I started using video in my classroom, my videos were probably 20 to 30 minutes long, but they probably also had about four different topics in there. So I asked my students, would you rather have more videos that are shorter or fewer videos that are longer? Hands down, the feedback I got was, we'll take as many as you give us, but make them short, one topic per video.
Mm-hmm.
They just wanted them small, digestible chunks. So I covered the same content, but I had, you know, I just used more individual learning objects to deliver the content. And so, and they were able to consume, you know, the students could kind of consume them in smaller bite-sized chunks. But my students were doing that anyhow. They would watch 5 minutes and hit pause and go do something else. Then they'd come back and they'd watch five more minutes and hit pause and then go do something else. So, maybe I am contributing to shorter attention spans, but then again, I may just be meeting the students where they're at and trying to help them learn.
Well, maybe, and maybe there's information or studies that show this, maybe we learn things after 5 minutes and they stay with us better than if you labor over something for 40 minutes and then try to remember what you learned the first 5 minutes. It may be harder, huh?
Yeah, you know, and I think that's kind of the way video works. Like I said, big bang for your buck early on, but the longer it goes, you're not going to remember it as much. Whereas text, if you sit down and you slog through text for an hour, you know, and read, you're probably far more likely to retain more of that than you did on after watching, you know, an hour of video content.
Hmm. Nick is next in Madison. Hi, Nick.
Hi. First off, good afternoon. This is a fantastic subject. I just wanted to say I'm an adult learner. Started college late after military service, and after my first degree, I went into the medical field. And my first anatomy and physiology instructor used a very paper and pencil version of this. He gave us blank outlines with headers, and required us to read certain parts of the textbook and fill that outline in. And so, in doing so, made us read the content and kinesthetically put everything on paper. And then when we got to class, it wasn't a lecture anymore. It was then a discussion. And as long as you took the time, you had a good discussion.
Okay. Aaron?
Yeah, so what you're mentioning is some of the feedback that I get from a lot of teachers, that the kids who actually take the time to engage with the content, they are far more likely to get more out of the class. No, I mean, there are always the students who show up and they haven't engaged with content ahead of time. And so, you know, you have some options at that point as a teacher. Do you sit down and do direct teaching to those students anyhow, or do you send them, you know, maybe you have a computer in the back of your classroom you can send them back to put on a set of headphones, and they can engage with the content while you then, you know, engage students with other more interesting learning activities. So you kind of have to make a decision as a teacher how you're going to deal with with the reluctant learners. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. The ones that do take the time to engage are far more likely to be engaged in class. But you also point out that this is really, again, nothing new. People have been using elements of pre-teaching for a long, long time, be that read the book and then come to class, or, like you said, you know, engage in this outlining process before you come to class. This isn't new. I mean, there were professors in Miami University in Ohio in the early 90s that were kind of did this with PowerPoint slideshows. They said, here, look through my PowerPoint slide deck first before you come to class, and then we're going to kind of get some of that low-end content out of the way, and then when you come to class, we're going to engage with it at a higher level. And now with the advent of just really quick and easy to make video, we're just leveraging another medium to do similar things pedagogically.
Hmm. Anything else, Nick?
I am now furthering my degree field, and I intend to teach people how to do what I do. And I truly intend to use this type of video content. Right now I'm 100% online, so I'm actually pretty engaged with integrity videos and discussion boards, because it's the only way we have to actually commune. And I think it's absolutely fantastic.
Thanks. That's excellent.
Thank you, Nick. Thanks so much for the call. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Erin Sams is our guest, and we're talking about the flipped classroom this hour of the program, which is essentially changes the lecture to a shorter video and then engagement with the teacher in question and answer and other things in the classroom after the homework, which is traditionally what happened in the classroom, is done at home. What do you think? Phone lines are open for you. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go back to your phone calls now. Matt in Beloit. Hello, Matt.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I attended one of Jonathan's seminars and read the book that he and Jonathan wrote on flipping, and flipped my freshman U.S. history class last year, and it was just an amazing success on every level. Beloit is high poverty, high minority, high transiency, high ESL, and it just... It was an amazing experience.
Mm. So what did you do? Now we've got a different subject matter, history. What did you do with your videos, Matt?
Yeah, I had about 10 to 12-minute videos on the content that I would have delivered in class, my basic lectures, my PowerPoints that I would have done, that I've done in the past, and recorded them online, put them on YouTube, and the students watched them and came to class prepared for the most part.
Mm. What if they don't come prepared?
I tried to make an alternative that was less appealing than watching a YouTube video. So instead of watching a YouTube video, they would have a book assignment that would be the same content, but not as they didn't enjoy it as much, I'd say. They'd say, Mr. Flynn, this is way harder than watching the video.
Mm.
And I'd say, yeah, I know. I want you to watch the video.
Mm-hmm.
And that cut down on a lot of that. And like Aaron said, the kids that aren't going to watch the videos or the kids that aren't going to do the homework anyway. But it really, talking about flipping, it flipped my learning and grading completely. My number of Fs went down dramatically. My number of A's and B's skyrocketed.
Huh.
It was just, it was great.
Huh. And the students seemed more engaged?
Oh, definitely. I mean, they, you don't have to, I don't give lectures anymore, which is part of a history. Any history teacher has to give lectures, and
sure.
I lectured 0 days last year. You know, so doing a lot more technology projects. Beloit's going 1-to-1 with iPads this next year. Just gave us a lot more time to dive into primary sources, inquiry-based lessons, like Aaron mentioned. The class went so much smoother
mm-hmm.
this year, and it's my seventh year teaching, so it was good.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. more support for the whole idea, Aaron.
Yeah, something that that I did after maybe probably year four or so of doing this is I had a lot of students who said, Mr. Sams, I prefer to read the textbook instead of watching your videos. Can I do that instead? And my answer to that was absolutely yes. I got to the point where, I didn't care if the kid watched my video to learn. What I was more concerned with is that they actually just learned. And so I moved to kind of an objective-based grading system, standards-based grading, you might hear it called as well, where I had 100 topics that I wanted my students to master in my chemistry class. And I had a video for each of those topics, and some of them were, to be honest, not very good. And some students chose to learn in other ways, by reading the textbook. Some students would just do an internet search for the objective itself and learn some other way online, and some would just learn from their peers. And I got to the point where I didn't care how they learned it, I just wanted them to learn it. So after a few years of using video, I didn't require that students watched my video content, but it was there as an available learning resource. So, some students are going to learn better from reading a text. Some students are going to learn better through experience. Some students are going to learn better through multimedia. I want to give kids some choice and some autonomy in that and then help them figure out how they learn best.
Mm-hmm.
Just get them to do that as best they can.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Matt, so much for your call. John in Janesville, hi.
Hello, Kathleen. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, John.
I'm flipping actually a classroom right now in algebra at a college level, and it's, to be honest with you, it has surprised me how much time it takes to create the videos. Now, this for the semester, I've only flipped two channels. chapters out of 8 in a whole semester, but it takes a lot of time. It took me probably about a month of just sitting down and making a video. So there's definitely a time investment, and there's a learning curve for the software. But the benefit comes, I think, during the semester when you have more free time, personally, but also in classroom, to kind of, you know, assess students and kind of move them along wherever they're at.
Mm-hmm.
The question I have for you, though, is how do you specifically, I guess, what software do you use and what kind of ways do you disseminate the information? Do you use YouTube or a server on at school?
Yeah, so there, you know, you bring up a lot of good points. One is that, yes, this does take time. There is a large initial investment of time, but as you said, it pays off in the long run. So I never want anyone to think that I'm telling you that this is easy or that it makes your life easier or anything like that, because it is a lot of work. But then again, most things worth doing are. So I encourage you to give it a shot. So in terms of hardware and software, I use a product called Camtasia Studio. It's a screen recording software to record whatever's on my computer screen. It also records my webcam and my voice, and it has some video editing features built into it as well. I got to the point after a couple of years of using that, you know, if I was going to create a 10-minute video, it would take me 30 minutes to produce. So 10 minutes to record and 20 minutes of editing time. And to be honest, I cut myself off after that. You can spend hours and hours and hours and hours editing video until it's perfect, but often you have to ask yourself, do I need a perfect or do I need it on Tuesday? And I know for me, Tuesday usually won.
Right.
And so
right.
Mine were not super high, you know, not polished, professional, high production value videos. These were, you know, highly functional tools that I was using to teach my students. So, I liked Camtasia Studio. There's a lot of other options out there. Just look for, you know, screen recording tools or whiteboarding apps on a tablet device. So, lots and lots of options. Actually, if you go, I have a nonprofit organization that we've set up to kind of help train teachers along these lines. FlippedLearning.org, and there's a resource page that gives you lots of hardware and software options there. In terms of where you put your videos, my recommendation to teachers is to pick one method and do it well. I put my stuff everywhere. We started putting our content, John and I, on our internal servers at our school. The problem we were finding there is when we had 200 kids trying to access the same file at night, in our little mountain town in Colorado that didn't have a whole lot of infrastructure, we were basically bottlenecking the thing.
Mm-hmm.
We were bottlenecking the internet lines in and out of the school. We were crashing the servers, so that was not working. So at that point, we decided to put them out on the internet. At that time, Google had not acquired YouTube yet, so we were using Google Video. And then we have since put them on YouTube. We also use a service called Screencast.com. There's other places like Vimeo. There's school-friendly ones called like TeacherTube or SchoolTube. I haven't used either of those in a while. I'm not sure if they're still around. So there's lots and lots of options, lots of places to put your content. One limiting factor is often that some of those things are blocked at different schools. So if you want your students to be able to access them in school, you'll need to find something that they can get to in school. But if you're only having them access it outside of school, then, you know, something like YouTube, they're all familiar with how that works. So one consideration, though, is if you do have students who don't have access to the internet at home, you're going to want to produce your videos on a video file that you can actually distribute that file to your student. So instead of doing it online, you know, be able to put it on a DVD or a flash drive or some sort of physical media to get it to the students on some device that they can view it on at home.
Is that helpful, John?
One caveat, I guess one follow-up question. For YouTube, because it sounds like you've used YouTube a little bit, do you have any limitations for bandwidth or the number of people who can access it at one certain time?
Not that I've encountered. I mean, I've pretty sure the Google has all the bandwidth they could possibly want. So I've never run into any problems there.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, John, very much for the call. He expressed a concern that I would imagine more than a few teachers would have if they haven't done this before. Some people have a little bit of stage fright. They don't exactly know how to present themselves or how to make this interesting. It can be intimidating.
Yeah, definitely. One thing that I encourage teachers to consider, well, a couple things. One is to find a partner. I did this with my colleague Jonathan Bergman, and I don't think I would have been able to do this without having someone alongside to bounce ideas off of, to produce content with. I could not have done this alone. initially, when our first year, we split up the workload. He would do Unit 1, I would do Unit 2, and so on. And then we got to the point where we would just have we would do these together, and we'd have a conversation about the content and more instead of just more of a dissemination of the information. And it worked really well. It made it really dialogical. I mean, we're on a radio show right now. You're not the only person talking. We're having a dialogue, and it makes it more engaging. There's questions,
right.
There's answers. So one of us would often play the expert, and the other of us would, you know, ask all the silly questions that people always ask about topics, and you know, we had enough years of experience under our belt that we could anticipate some of these questions that people would have and ask all the common misconception questions, and so we found that to be very, very valuable. And if you have a teacher who maybe lacks some of the technological skills, maybe if they partnered with someone who has the tech savvy who may not be a content expert, that would be a good partnership. So you know, play to your strengths and find people to complement your weaknesses as you go down this road.
Clay in Pulaski, hello.
Hello. I actually had the same exact question as a previous one about the tools to use. So my other question would be, since I'm an integration specialist in a school district, who would be a couple of people that are flipping the classroom, which in a great way that I could show other teachers, hey, look at this. This is how they're doing it, so that they might be able to get some ideas.
Oh, wow. That's certainly a content area and grade level specific type question. But I would encourage you, if you go to flippedclassroom.org, we've got a network of 14,000 teachers who are sharing their ideas there.
Wow.
It's a Ning network. You do have to sign up. We were getting spammed, and so you have to go through an approval process. We basically just have to make sure you're a person and a teacher. But that's a great place to go to get ideas, to share ideas, to find people in your subject area or your grade level who are using these concepts in their classroom. And there's a lot of people who are very active and more than willing to share their ideas on there. So that's flippedclassroom.org.
All right. Thanks, Clay. Deb in Rice Lake. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hey, I just wanted to, say thank you for having the show. It's fabulous. And I've read just about everything that they have published online at Flip Classroom. I went to the conference in Stillwater, so thank you very much for that.
Thanks for coming.
The one thing I just wanted to add is that I'm trying to do this year. I teach at a tech college, and I teach in the architecture program. So it's a completely, it's kind of a different, with technology and teaching software. There are some limitations there, but...
Hello, Deb.
For my needs. But one of the things that works out really awesome for me is collaborative things like Google Docs and Google Forms.
All right, your phone is kind of erratic, but you got most of that, I would assume?
Yeah, it sounds like she was just using some collaborative tools, Google Docs, Google Forms. I'm assuming that would be to engage with the students, and that is a very powerful tool where, if you can have students giving feedback on the content that they've viewed using any of those collaborative devices. I've even talked to teachers and professors who they kind of have an open, class set of notes where they open up. There's a Google Doc for the entire class to contribute information to during the note-taking process, and they can build off of each other's. That's something I do when I do workshops is I just open up a collaborative document for my sessions, and everyone can kind of take notes together. So that's definitely a great collaborative tool. And then I know teachers who don't teach anywhere near each other, and they use like Google Plus Hangouts or other online collaboration tools like that or video conferencing tools to make content together. There are teachers that I know that live in different states that create video content together for their students in their respective classrooms, and they've never even met each other physically.
Huh. Thanks, Deb. One more call, one more minute. Jake in Madison.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to, I'm actually currently a student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and when I think to my experiences in the classes, when the teachers incorporate, like, the Google Docs or those technology resources, it makes the lesson so much more engaging, and like he mentioned with the Google Docs, taking notes collaboratively as a class, teachers that do that, it brightens up the lesson, and you have ideas that you never thought about from other students, and sometimes the teachers will even make comments on the notes directly while you're in class, and it just really makes learning more engaging.
Well, that's what the hopeful outcome is of all of this, right, Aaron?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think one of the key components of learning in general is just the idea of relationship and community. I mean, learning can happen by yourself, but if you think about it, if you're reading a book, even if that book was written by someone thousands of years ago, you really have a sort of relationship with that person. I mean, you have a connection with this person, even if they're long gone, with their thoughts and with their ideas and with their beliefs about the world. And so education doesn't happen in a vacuum. It happens within a community, and the more rich we can make that experience for the learners, the better. And I really hope that Flip Classroom and Flip Learning helps facilitate that.
Thank you, Aaron. Interesting hour. Aaron Sams, our guest. Thanks to KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning for producing the show. Tomorrow, Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, Migrant Farm Workers in the United States. That's the first hour of the show. The second hour of the program, we will get a preview of PBS documentary on the march, and also Channel 10 Public Television in Milwaukee documentaries tomorrow night. Thanks for listening.